Welcome to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline. Before we get started today, I have a favor to ask our listeners. Caroline is turning 85 on June 8th, 2020. And if you've been listening to the show for a while, you know that Caroline loves sending and receiving mail. So we would like to ask you to send a birthday card. We're making it a surprise, so send it to Caroline Kilborn, care of Monica Hadley, P.O. Box 337, Fairfield, Iowa, 52556. That's P.O. Box 337, Fairfield, Iowa, 52556. Thank you, and now on with the show. Welcome to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline. I'm your host, Monica Hadley, and my mother, Caroline Kilborn, is on the other end of the line.
Yes, I am. I'm here.
Yay! And fortunately, even though we're, you know, still quarantined, it's a beautiful day outside. We get to get outside a little bit. And...
Yes, yes.
Yeah.
Indeed.
So,
beautiful
Mom,
to see the sunshine.
Oh, yeah. Mom, why don't you introduce our guest today?
Okay. My pleasure to do that. Our book today is Glorious Boy, and it is written by Amy Liu. And she is a best-selling author of the novels Flash House, Cloud Mountain, and Face, and memoirs Gaining the Truth About Life After Eating Disorders and Solitaire. Her books have been translated into more than a dozen languages, published as a Literary Guild super release, and serialized in Good Housekeeping. She received a Barnes & Noble Discover Great New Writers Award, a Busk Fiction Award, and special mention in the by the Pushcart Prize. And she has she holds an MFA in creative writing from Bennington College and is on the faculty of Goddard College MFA in creative writing program at Port Townsend, Washington. She lives in Los Angeles. And this book is very interesting, and it joins one of the many written by authors around the world about the Second World War, the end of the Second World War. And welcome to Lord Writer's Voices, Amy.
Thank you so much. I'm delighted to be here.
So, Amy, the Glorious Boy, it is about World War II, or events around World War II, but it's a little different than most World War II books we read. It's not set in Europe. It is not focused on kind of battles or underground resistance so much. Tell us a little bit about the setting and why you chose this setting.
This setting is probably the most fascinating place I've ever learned about in my life. It's the Andaman Islands is an archipelago that is off the coast, about a couple hundred miles off the coast of Burma, and it used to be part of the British India during the Raj. And it is currently, most of it is held by the Indian government now. And it was, during the war, it was the farthest west that the Japanese got. It was their westernmost occupied territory during the war. But it also is home to indigenous tribes that date back 60,000 years. And it is this collision of cultures. It's really remarkable because during the British Raj, it was used as a penal colony for freedom fighters, the Indians who fought for their independence from colonial rule. They got arrested for mutinying against the British and were sent to this penal colony in the middle of the ocean. And there was a British colony abounded there because they needed British administrators to oversee the convicts. And over time, that little colony in the town of Port Blair grew into kind of a strange mix of civilians and convicts and British colonial administrators and plantation owners who were going out and you know, felling these primeval trees in the island and growing coconut and other things like that. So even before the Japanese arrived, it was just this fascinating combination of cultures in the middle of these islands that were otherwise completely wild and gorgeous, and you know, trees that towered hundreds of feet in the air, and rainforest, and these indigenous tribes deep in the forest that were uncontacted and unstudied. So that was when I discovered all this history, I was just hooked.
And how did you discover this? Because I've certainly never heard of these.
Yeah,
islands.
It was a chance meeting with an anthropologist's wife who had just come back from the Andaman Islands. They had been closed to foreign visitors until the 1990s. And she was one of the first foreigners. She and her husband, the anthropologist, had gone there because they'd heard about these indigenous tribes in this remarkable place. And she just happened to come to a book reading I was giving for one of my earlier novels. And I mentioned that I was interested in writing about India, and she piped up that this was the most interesting part of India that she'd ever heard of. And that was the beginning. More than 20 years ago, I heard about it. And so it lingered in the back of my mind for years before I found the story that really belonged there.
So you decided to, the characters that are there are unusual. You know, it's the main, I don't know who the point, tell us who the point of view characters are of the story and what's unusual about each of them.
Well, there are three point of view characters, and really the first one came to me. She's a young local girl who lives in the island, and she is extremely attached to the little boy who is the glorious boy of the title, who's 4 years old, and he's the son of the civil surgeon, the doctor of the colony, and the doctor's wife, who is an aspiring anthropologist who's interested in studying the tribes. But the little boy is mute, and his muteness, inexplicable because otherwise he seems perfectly well and healthy, is a source of tension and jealousy within the family, because the only person who can easily communicate with the child is this young girl who is taking care of him. She's basically their nanny. And these three point of view characters are Nyla, the young girl, and Claire, the mother, and Shep, the father. And their story came to me in a dream. Several years after I'd first heard about the Andamans, I had a dream in which this young girl and this little boy were hiding, and the young girl was hiding the child from the parents because there was an evacuation underway, and she knew that she was going to be left behind, and she didn't want to give up the child. She didn't want to be left behind. And so she, being only 13 or 14, a young teenager, decided to get her revenge on the parents by hiding the child. And when they come out of hiding, everybody has gone. The evacuation has been completed. There's smoke rising in the distance, and she realizes, oh my God, what have I done? And so that was a dream that I had that woke me up in the middle of the night, sent
wow.
me to my death to start fighting.
Wow.
At that point, I mean, I had this sense that I wanted it to be the Andamans, but I didn't know the whole World War II history of the Andamans, and I hadn't been to the islands. So the book really struggled for several years until finally I got to India and I went to the Andamans, and that's where I learned the whole history of the Japanese invasion, and that there had, in point of fact, been a very sudden emergency evacuation of all of the British and that was in 1942, and that there was some of the British were left behind, and there was supposed to be another evacuation ship for all the soldiers and the military police and the British who were left behind. And that book never arrived in time. The Japanese got there first. So there were characters left behind, as there are in my book, in the story.
I want you to explain, if you would, this muteness that this boy has. And I understand from reading the book that it's known as Einstein syndrome.
Oh, yes. Uh-huh. That's another completely fascinating thing. For some reason, in my dream, he was mute. That was there from the very beginning. And I don't know what it signifies in my psyche, but when I started to sort of look around for reasons why a child might be mute, I discovered this fascinating syndrome called Einstein syndrome, because Einstein himself didn't speak until he was about 4 years old. And it is something that happens with extremely brilliant, creative, certain people. Lots of physicists have this condition, lots of composers, musicians, you know, very, very complex thinkers when they're babies and little children. I think that they think, nobody knows for sure, but they think that their minds are so working in such interesting ways that parts of the brain are developing before the speech centers. And so they become, they go for several years without speaking, and then their language is delayed. It's fine. There's absolutely nothing wrong with them, but there is a syndrome. They're very temperamental. And it makes sense if you think of these extremely acute minds that are very, very focused and working at a higher level and on different things. How the world works, how, you know, what nature is doing around them, that sort of thing. Then when they're interrupted, they throw temper tantrums, and they're very delayed on the kinds of ordinary development things like potty training that everybody else expects them to do, because their minds are preoccupied with more important business from the point of view of a 3-year-old. And it so happened that while I was trying to pull this together, I discovered that there's a member of my family, one of my niece's children, seems to have this syndrome. He didn't speak until he was almost 3 years old, and he is extremely fascinated by nature and science and art and light and color, and just seems to be preoccupied with his own thoughts much of the time. And there's absolutely nothing wrong with him. He's perfectly healthy and he's perfectly normal, but he just has this very interesting mind. So that's the character in my book.
Yeah. That's extremely, that whole thing is extremely interesting to me, because, you know, you would think that if a child has all these interests, they would want to tell everybody about them, you know?
Yeah.
And instead of being mute about it. I mean, that's just, I don't know. So it's extremely interesting.
Yeah, it is. And we still don't know very much about it. And it's complicated, as you might expect, because when children don't speak, there is fears of autism and or being on the spectrum. And certainly you can't say that just being mute is a sign that you have Einstein's and that there's nothing to worry about. But it is a possibility that that there is nothing wrong at all. So it's important that parents get their kids checked out and tested, and you know, make sure that you know, if they're worrying, they're not worrying unnecessarily. And one of the complexities for the characters in my story, of course, was that they, Ty is born in 1937. So there was no speech therapy back then. And there certainly wasn't any speech therapy in the Andaman Islands in the middle of the British Raj. So these were two parents who were marooned, you know, in this very strange place and really without any kind of, understanding of how to deal with this child. And it just so happened that there was this young girl who bonded with him and had an intuitive relationship with him. And that was a source of great jealousy and strain within the family.
You're listening to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline. Our guest today is Amy Liu, author of Glorious Boy. And of course, to complicate matters even more, the native tribes on that island had a wordless language, an ability to communicate without words as well. And Claire, as the mother and a budding anthropologist, was trying to understand them and learn that language or how they communicated that way. Is that accurate? Do the tribes on the Andaman Islands actually have that way of communicating, or is that something that you created?
No, I think that is true of most indigenous tribes, actually. Sadly, the tribe that they're based on is virtually extinct at this point, as most of the tribes in the Andamans are. They, like many of our native populations, they started to be wiped out as soon as the white man appeared with their diseases and their, you know, abuse and their violence. But the Bia tribe that this is based on were there into the 30s, and their survivors, the few remaining survivors, are still there on the islands. And for example, these are the tribes that we heard of during the 2004 tsunami, who managed to get word to all of their people to get to higher grounds when the tsunami came in. So, none of the indigenous tribes were, killed by the tsunami, whereas the coastal dwellers, the Indians, the people who had immigrated to the islands, that were not from this heritage, many of them got wiped out, with the tsunami and the rising. But they're, you know, the indigenous tribes have a way of reading nature and communicating with each other, that, you know, we just don't understand. And that's a fascinating part of that lore.
Twins often have a secret language, too,
yes,
that they communicate, don't they?
With one another. Yep.
I've read that, yeah. Yeah. That is interesting.
And also, Claire had this tremendous respect for the Bia tribe who could do that and yet wasn't sort of able to accept this similar way of communicating with her son and Nyla. As normal,
yeah.
You know, she had trouble
with
that.
Well, it's not that. I think she did have trouble with that, but I think what the real problem with Claire and Ty was there was an attachment problem from the very beginning. And one of the aspects of this book that I hope will resonate with a lot of women who read it, mothers who read it, is this sense that she had these bigger goals that she was really wedded to. She wanted to make a name she wanted to do more interesting things. She was very, very young. She was only 22 when she was swept off her feet by Shep and went to this place. And the reason that they had a whirlwind romance and got married and went to the Andamans really was that he'd been assigned there as a doctor, and she kind of hitched herself to him because there were these tribes that she would get to study, and she was enthralled by Margaret Mead. And, you know, before they even landed, she was pregnant. And so she had this baby who was a difficult, challenging, different baby. And she found it difficult to attach to him. That bonding didn't happen. As I said, these kids tend to be extremely temperamental. They have tantrums. They are not cooperative children. And that was problematic for her. And at the same time, she had this sense of being torn because she, you know, she loved this child, but he was making it very difficult to love him. And then she had connected with these people in the forest who were feeding her in a different way. And I think a lot of women can identify with that. If you have work that you love, and then you have a problem child at home that you also love, but there is that tension and that feeling of being torn and not really knowing which way to turn. And that's where she is in the early part of the book.
And of course, she's far from home, far from everything familiar, doesn't have any kind of extended family to help. Not that they necessarily would have been much help if she'd been closer, because she has her own issues from the past,
right,
that are playing into this too. But it's also during a time when perhaps there was not as much support for a woman to have a meaningful career as there is now. And so that would have made things even more difficult, more challenging.
Yes. And don't forget, she's an American in a British colony. And the few other women who were around were extremely traditional in their views about women's role, even though they were living in a outlandishly different and unique setting. They weren't traipsing off into the forest. They were not studying the tribes. They were extremely racist in their views. And she was extremely modern in her views. So she wasn't getting any help or support from them. There's a lot of a story that falls on the cutting room floor when you're in the final stages of writing the book. And I did have quite a bit about her relationship with the other British wives in the colony. And for better or for worse, a lot of that ended up, you know, in my head, but not necessarily fully in the pages.
I was going to say, I don't remember reading much about that, about these other women.
Yeah. But I tried to allude to them without going into detail. Yeah.
Okay. And then there's Shep, the father, who, what made you decide to have him have been raised in China?
Well, that's my father. My father was raised in China, and I have, you know, I've written two books that are set mostly in this straddling of worlds between China and America. And so I have his story in me, and I just found it an interesting parallel that he goes back and forth, and he was raised in that era where the book Kim, Rudyard Kipling's book Kim, plays a fairly large role in his story. And I found it fascinating to compare the whole British colonial aspect in China and the British colonial aspect in India. There are many parallels, but there are also many differences. And so I enjoyed playing with that. In his case, and he really didn't have a good relationship with his family, and he really didn't have any support from them. And he's his character is very much twisted by his early life, and especially his relationship with his father, who was a.
And when you say he, you're referring to Shep, not your father.
To Shep. Yeah, oh, yeah, Shep. Yeah. Absolutely, Shep.
Yeah,
but that's, I mean, he comes from my father, but he's definitely his own character, his own
right.
Neat character.
how, you know, I don't know as much about the British colonialism in China as, you know, I think I've heard more about India because of Gandhi and so forth. How did the Chinese get the British to leave?
Well, it all ended up with World War II, basically. Mm-hmm. You know, World War II was pretty much the end of colonialism in Asia. Lots of evacuations. The Japanese beat them, and that was pretty much the end of it.
So the Japanese kicked them out, and then the Japanese persecuted the Chinese.
Yes, and that followed. That's in this story too. The Indian freedom fighters, many of them welcomed the Japanese because they saw that they viewed the Japanese as their Asian brethren, and the Japanese at the time fed that illusion. So that in this story, when the Japanese land, a lot of the local Indians who have been descended from convicts or were themselves freedom fighters welcomed the Japanese with open arms. And, you know, historically, much of the history about the Japanese invasion and occupation in this book is historically accurate. So within 48 hours of the occupation, the Japanese were basically raping and vandalizing and executing the locals in order to assert their control over them. So it really didn't take long before the illusion of Asian brethren was turned on its head, unfortunately.
Yeah, Asia for Asians. You're listening to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is Amy Liu, author of Glorious Boy. Amy, why don't you read a little bit from the book?
Okay. I would be happy to. I've selected a passage, which is when Claire and Shep are first arriving in the Andamans. So it'll give you a sense of the setting and hopefully a little bit of foreboding about some of the issues that are to come. They're on the ship approaching the archipelago at this point, and they've really only known each other for a few weeks because their romance was such a whirlwind. But this is like very, very intimidating in some ways and very romantic in others. First, a small, uninhabitable pincushion of palm trees appeared on the turquoise sea. Then a massive green monolith rose behind it, like a waking dinosaur. The behemoth's coat of forest green undulated, dense and vast as a creature in its own right, a creature intent on driving the slender white snake of beach back into the ocean. This was North Andaman, the top of the island chain that would terminate for them in the south at Port Blair. "There's no one there," she said, stunned by the confounding shimmer of beauty, humidity, and primeval heat that seemed to pulse from shore. "No see-ems," Shep quipped, but his heart wasn't in it either. Claire gripped the bulwark, fighting a spasm of nausea. His arm wound like a question mark around her waist. It didn't help. Who did they think they were fooling? Both of them, imposters. Over the next 6 hours, the shoreline remained relentlessly wild. They spotted a couple of isolated coastal villages, but even these looked deserted. Then a distant lighthouse blinked. Atop a bluff beyond, a regimental block of concrete rose, spiked with gleaming antenna. "There!" Shep looked up from the gazetteer, spread-eagled in his palm. Hope and relief cracked his voice as he pointed to the outer bank of Ross Island, their new home. The hillock stretched like a long green breaker at the entrance to a harbor that abruptly bristled with boats. A mirage is how Claire would record this first impression. A miniature replica of a world she thought she'd left behind. A dark Gothic church with a soaring steeple. The semblance of a town square and parade ground. Victorian houses along the ridge with gabled roofs and wide verandas, pale gingerbread trim. The colonial residents themselves were scarce, but small brown figures in white uniforms appeared and disappeared among the towering shade trees. Their numbers multiplied toward the southern end of the island, where the western architecture yielded to a dark brick scramble of shop houses and the humanity of a bazaar. The Hindu temple on the waterfront resembled a multicolored stack of lifesavers. The Ross cantonment was the seat of British power for the entire Andaman archipelago. But to reach it, they had first to continue across the harbor to disembark on the so-called mainland, where Port Blair proper stretched like a lizard's claw out of the forest's interior. There, whitewashed bungalows like those throughout India ranged along the slopes, and high on the lizard's outermost knuckle stood an imposing fortress with rose-colored crenellations. The cellular jail, Shep said. Claire gazed up at the pink castle walls. Inside, reputedly, the Raj's most hardened convicts sweltered. By design, the whole port functioned as one vast concentration camp. But since the inmates' dominant crime was their will to fight for independence, Claire felt far more disgust for their British overlords than she did any fear of the prisoners themselves. The anxiety playing across Chep's face told her he'd been dreading this reckoning as much as she'd been refusing to think about it. He was now working for those overlords, after all, and she was their subject by marriage. "It's strangely picturesque," she offered. "Maybe things won't be so bad." As if in confirmation, travelers' palms waved like giant hands, welcoming them to Phoenix Bay Jetty, where the mood seemed downright festive. There, Europeans and Indians and everything in between, soldiers, civilians, and Pukka Sahibs, barefoot Indian and Burmese women wearing scarlet, turquoise, and canary yellow, called to arriving passengers. Children and pie dogs scuttled around waiting rickshaws. Cries of "Chow" and "Boy" skittered across the harbor. Suddenly the deck tipped. The anchor splashed, and Claire's gaze was thrown down and back toward the stern, where a dozen manacled convicts who must have made the crossing inside the ship's bowels stood waiting for a tender to take them ashore. A single voice had begun to chant, "Inchalab Zindabad! Inchalab Zindabad!" The others took it up. "Long live the revolution!" Claire and Shep had heard this and other nationalist slogans rising in the distance and behind closed gates during their week-long stopover in Calcutta. But this one now was chased by the sickening thwack of bone and flesh and wood. The victim screamed as the others fell silent. A rear gangway lowered. The prisoners shuffled onto the bobbing tender, prodded by their armed guards. Shep took hold of Claire's elbow. She heard his voice climb. "Steady on, darling. No apologies, no regrets." It sounded like a plea. They took a little wooden ferry back to Ross Island and tried to put the prisoners' cries behind them as they walked to the top of the ridge. There they landed in front of the low red gate to the civil surgeon's bungalow. Shep flipped the latch, and they stepped through to a vivid green lawn ringed with coconut palms, birds of paradise, flaming heliconia, and orchids of every description. The bungalow itself had freshly whitewashed walls and a wide triangular red tin roof with gables at either end. A deep columned veranda ran the length of the house, overlooking the sea. It was late in the afternoon. Thick stripes of jade-green ocean laddered to meet the sky. The air had a queer golden vitality, like jazz music made visible. "We're home," Shep said, as if testing the gods. "We're home," Claire answered, taking his hand. "Welcome to paradise, my love."
And certainly have a way with details, I will say.
Thank you.
And thank you, Amy, for reading from Glorious Boy. How long did you spend working on this book?
Well, from that first dream that set up the story until now, that was 17 years.
Okay.
So, on and off, not consistently or continuously, but I had lots and lots of different iterations. As I said, when I started, I didn't know the World War II history. So I spent a long time trying to, kind of concoct a false history of the islands that might have taken place in the 1980s. And that just didn't get off the ground. It wasn't until 2010 that I actually went to the Andamans and I discovered a bunch of books that were local. They were not available anywhere else in the world. I had to go there in order to get my hands on them. And they really laid the whole story out for me when I got all of this detailed history about the Japanese occupation and what life had been like on Ross Island, just for ordinary people to live there. That's when I finally was able to really get going and start writing the book. So I would say, that was 10 years ago now.
Okay, that makes sense. I was wondering how you researched life on these islands. What was available, where was it available? And you just answered that, not much until you actually went to the islands.
That's exactly right. There was hardly anything. There's more online now, but of course, when I started this back in 2003, there wasn't much of anything online. We were all just getting accustomed to the internet in those days.
Right.
So now it's, used to having everything at our fingertips, but 20 years ago, that wasn't the case. So, and this stuff, this very, very local, these were books and pamphlets written by people who literally had grown up on Ross Island in the 1930s. And I've found that through the years, all my fiction depends heavily on firsthand accounts that were of the time period that I'm writing about.
Where did you actually find them? Was there a library or a museum, or how did you find this material?
Well, I had just this fabulously generous, wonderful guide. In Asia, in India, many places, because of the language barrier, and especially in a place like the Andaman Islands, where they were still, even in 2010, they were still fairly new to foreign visitors. When you go, usually you need to have a guide. And so we had a guide the whole time we were on the islands. And when we went to Ross Island and he found out what I was looking for, he went to, there was a gift shop, called it a gift shop, information, and it was closed actually, but he got them to open it up and he came out with an armload of all of this stuff. I owe the entire book to him, really. Put it that way, because I'm not sure I would have gotten it without him.
And how did it feel when you saw what you had?
Well, I remember that I was on the plane. We were flying back to the mainland of India when I first had a real chance to open these books and start reading them. And I just was galvanized. There is a native, historically accurate, one of the Bia characters did, in point of fact, work for the British espionage services. And he was a spy during World War II. And it was the point at which I read about him, and I just lifted him completely out of the pages of this this book that I was reading and put him into my novel, because he was too good to be true. But that was one of so many discoveries that I just I knew I was finally on the right track with the book at that point.
Wow. Do you think that now that you can research so much on the internet and you never really have to go someplace, and people write books set in places that they never go, do you think we're losing something because of that?
I don't know. I will never be somebody who can write about a place. I think this exercise actually has proven that to me, because I did try to write it from my imagination for several years, and it just, I'm not that kind of writer. I know that there are many writers who can do that and they do a beautiful job. I'm not one of them. I have to go to a place. I have to smell it. I can have to taste it. I have to see the colors. I have to feel the textures. And I have to talk to the people and get a feel for the people who live there. And I have to, you know, dig and find interesting little bits that you can't get anywhere else. I just think that's the juice that I need to, you know, get my imagination going and get the creative impulse going. So I don't know. I mean, I think I know a lot of other writers like me, and I know some writers who can do it purely out of their imagination. So I'm not sure that anything is going to change in that. I do know that it's great to have this feast of information online that you can go to when you're writing a book, so that you can, you know, if you get stuck on a detail or a bit of information, you can usually answer, you know, I would say about 70% of it by going online. But there's always that killer 30% that
right.
You have to find some other way.
Now, what about Claire's time in India? How did you research that?
Well, a lot of the locations in her Indian time are based on places that I stayed, that I went to. I have quite a lot of lore of India in my background, because my family lived in India for 2 years when I was very, very young. And my mother is 99 years old, and people who meet her think that we must have spent at least 10 years in India, because they were clearly the two most important years of her life, and they have expanded in her mind and in her personal history. So I have grown up with India and people from India and the problems of India and the history of India very, very much part of my internal landscape. So I owe some of that to her, and some of it to the time that I spent being in India, part of which was researching for this book. And then a lot of the World War II British operations, special operations, a lot of that comes from online research. And again, thanks to the internet, you can find rare books all over the world. So I got a number of books from Australia about British operations in India during the war, especially espionage operations. And that comes in the later part of this story. The espionage operations that are described, and I won't say how they play into the role, because that might be giving too much of the plot away, but they are all based very, very, very closely on actual special operations that occurred in the Andaman Islands at that time.
Well, many of us now have heard about the women code breakers in the UK, you know, Bletchley Circle. But I didn't know that they had those in India as well, that they had women
absolutely
code breakers there.
They had them in India. They had them in Australia. Really, they were all over the world working very hard. And mostly they did tie back to Bletchley, but they were operating in the field, so to speak. Yeah.
And then, is it true that all those women then just had to sort of go home and be housewives afterwards?
I think unfortunately an awful lot of them did, yeah.
Wow. That would be a big change.
Yeah.
So, Amy, this obviously is not your first book, and you've written both novels and memoir. Are your other novels all historical novels as well?
I would say they are. My first book, Face, was perhaps the most personal book, the character was very, very, she was not me at all, but she lived in my world. And she was closer to my age. But in that book, I was kind of wrestling. I was trying to figure out a way to write my grandparents' story. And so it was kind of, I worked through a character who was like me to try and get into their story. And then the second book, Cloud Mountain, is based very close on my closely on my grandparents' story, because my grandmother, my father's mother, was an American, and she was married to a Chinese scholar revolutionary who was my grandfather, and they met and married around the time of the San Francisco earthquake and spent most of their married life in China. So that was a really fantastically interesting book, and that book is really very definitely historical. To the extent possible, it's based on their actual life story and where I departed from their actual life story. I based everything else on the history that surrounded them. The book that followed, Flash House, is much more of an invented story. The plot is completely invented, but it also is historical in terms of reflecting the history of India and the far western reaches of China immediately after the war, during the Cold War, and some of the espionage stuff that went along there. So, yeah, I guess I am a historical writer without ever having been officially a historian, but I...
But you must love history.
I do. And I love, mostly what I love are those firsthand accounts of people who lived extraordinary lives that nobody's ever heard of. And I love fictionalizing based on those, whether they come from my own family or books that I read.
We have some great family resources like that too, letters, troves of letters from the 1800s, and my goal is someday to actually go through all of that. Mom and I started a while ago, didn't we, Mom?
Yeah, we did.
We kind of got it. We got to get back to that.
Yeah, right. You're right.
Yeah.
You could probably write a book about it too.
Well, absolutely. Yeah, the one, you know, Amy Lou, I've talked about this before. We have these letters from a Civil War soldier in, who was like on a hospital ship in the Bay of Vicksburg during the Battle of Vicksburg.
Wow.
And other different times during the Civil War, you know, where he's writing back about really how the soldiers are seeing what's going on there. And it's fascinating.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, there are wonderful writers and they're not so good writers from any period in history. And if you've got that kind of material and it was somebody who really accounted for the details and was a good writer, that's great. My mother sent me the journal of one of her relatives who went on a clipper ship to Australia in something like 1840 or something. But unfortunately, the journal was, well, the sun came up today, and oh, the sea was rough, and it was sundown.
It certainly does sound like you have a lot of adventurous people in your family background, though.
Well, I think there are, you know, but when that's the only account you get of it, it doesn't really help.
Now, tell me a little bit about your memoirs. The titles of them are fascinating. So Gaining, The Truth About Life After Eating Disorders is one, and Solitaire is the other.
Well, when I was, I was a painter in college, and when I graduated from college, I lost my painting mojo and immediately flipped back into writing, which is what I had done before I went to college. And I think part of that was that during the whole period that I was in college and the end of my teens, I was anorexic. And by the time I got out of college, I was getting well, but I had never been treated. I never had any You know, nobody knew. This was 1975. Nobody really knew anything about eating disorders in those days. And I tripped across an article in Vogue magazine while I was trying to get my bearings as a writer and figure out what I was writing about and figure out how to write. And this article was the first article I'd ever seen that described anorexia nervosa. And I realized that that's exactly what I had experienced. And I realized that I'd never read anything other than this article about it, period. And I'd certainly never read a description of what it was like to be on the inside of an eating disorder like that, what was going on mentally inside my own mind during those years. And so I wrote, that was the first memoir of anorexia. And that was published in 1979. So that was my first book. And then I did a fair amount of publicity for it. And I think it made a big impression on a lot of people, because even to this day, I hear from people whose lives were changed by reading that book and discovering that they weren't alone and they weren't crazy in the way that everybody told them they were crazy, that they had a serious mental health illness. Yet I didn't want to be a professional anorexic for the rest of my life. And I didn't want to write just about that. So I moved away from that into many other topics. And I co-authored a number of books on psychological conditions. And then what happened was in the early 2000s, by that point, I was in my 50s, and I had stayed in touch with quite a number of my classmates from high school and from college. And by that time, we all knew who had had an eating disorder and who hadn't. And I found it fascinating to look back over our lives and see the parallels in the lives of people who had struggled with especially anorexia, but also somewhat bulimia. And some people had kicked it completely and some people had not, but everybody had what I came to call the half-life of eating disorders that kind of threaded through their ordinary lives, and it affected their parenting, it affected their marriages, it affected their relationships with work and career, certainly their ongoing relationships with their bodies and food. And I started to realize, or I started to suspect, that there was a very strong correlation between certain personality types and your predilection for certain eating disorders. And I began to investigate. I thought this could be an interesting book that would be sort of like what we know now about eating disorders that we didn't know then, and weave it through this issue of personality. And then when I started talking to the experts, the scientists in the field, I discovered that this was a new area of investigation for the researchers. And I was absolutely right in my suspicion. And they were just starting to get the data to confirm this and look at how certain innate qualities that are basically genetically controlled set certain people up for eating disorders, while they leave other people extremely unlikely to develop an eating disorder. So at that point, again, I was on to something that no one had ever written about before for a lay audience. So that's what Gaining became. It became a book that's what we know now that we didn't know back when I wrote Solitaire. And it was an entirely different kind of book, obviously. But
yeah. It must be very different writing those books than writing your novels.
Oh, completely. I mean, they're worlds apart. And I have to say, for me, nonfiction is so much easier than fiction. Fiction is just, it's much more rewarding, but it's so much more difficult. It's no comparison.
Wait, nonfiction is much easier than fiction.
For me, yes. Oh, absolutely.
That's fascinating. Yeah. Wow. Mm-hmm. Well, we're almost out of time. Just a little bit. This book comes out in May, I believe, Glorious Boy.
It comes out a week from, well, on May 12th.
On May 12th, okay.
On May 12th,
and
yes.
You had a whole list of appearances lined up. Are any of those actually going to be happening, do you think?
I'm afraid not probably physically happening, but virtually almost all of them are being transferred. So,
that's good.
Hopefully I will be able to meet everybody. So far, only one of them that I know of has been officially canceled, and that was going to be in Washington, D.C., and I'm sorry about that. Mm. But everything else looks like it's going to be taken into cyberspace.
And
yeah.
How
yeah.
has publishing, are books being published? Are they being pushed back? Are they staying on schedule? Do you know?
It's all over the map. Some books are being pushed back, and we wrestled with that decision on Glorious Boy and finally decided to keep it now because people need books. People are reading more than ever. The book industry is figuring out ways to get physical books to people, and also many, many people are reading digital versions.
Right.
E-books. Yeah. And also, going to be I do have some friends who have pushed their books back like to July and August, but I'm afraid there's going to be a glut of those books at that point, and there's going to be much more competition for attention. And to be brutally honest, we don't know whether we're all going to be out. We don't know whether it'll be any better to release a book than it is.
Yeah, so. That's for sure. I know I was just mainly concerned about the physical books, whether they're actually able to print them, actually able to distribute them. I know that the publicists who send me books are having trouble with physical copies. They're saying, can you do a digital version, which works fine for me. It's a little trickier for mom. So, our world's changing, but we'll come out of it with a new and better world, I hope. And certainly compared to what happened to your characters in Glorious Boy, we're not doing too badly.
Exactly. Also, just to put in a plug for bookshop.org, if your listeners don't know about bookshop.org, it is the way that you can order your books, and they give money back to independent booksellers. So you'll be supporting your local bookseller if you order books online through bookshop.org.
Great to know. Well, thank you so much for being with us, Amy. And Mom, do you have some closing words?
Yes, I do. You know that we've interviewed several authors that have written books about the Second World War and things. And so I just want to say that when the power of love overcomes the love of power, the world will have peace.
It's beautiful. Thank you.
Thank you, and thank you all for being with us. And see you next week on Writers' Voices.